A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm Anne Stickney, one of two lore-focused writers from Blizzard Watch, and I've got both of my wonderful co-hosts with me today, and we have so much to talk about, so let's just jump into the introductions. First up, he's a shaman columnist, he's also a lore aficionado, and that would be Joe Perez. Hey, Joe!
Well, hey there, everybody. And yes, we did have a busy weekend, me doubly so, because we also had Extra Life this weekend, so I want to take just a couple seconds to thank everybody who helped Signal Boost and raise
money
for Extra Life. Thank you so much for the last 25 hours in gaming at this point. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Okay. That's really awesome. Did you guys hit your goal?
We hit our goal. We actually hit above our goal as well. So it was really, really nice.
That's amazing. All right. And then also with us, he's the other lore-focused writer over on Blizzard Watch, and he's also apparently a prominent figure in Diablo Immortal, Matt Rossi. Hey, Rossi.
Finally, it can be told.
I was making a joke with him on the BlizzCon roundup, Joe, where I was like, why didn't you just tell us, you know, when you were telling us, when you were telling us about how great it was to play barbarians and stuff, why didn't you just tell us that you were one?
Because Sanctuary had him locked under an NDA. That's what happened.
Yep, that's exactly what I said.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, hey, how about that BlizzCon, huh?
Yeah, so that was the thing that just happened.
Oh, man, there was so much.
We have a lot to talk about. There was a lot of news reveals, of course, and, you know, stuff about content and things like that. But we're focused on lore here, and there was quite a lot of that, too. So let's just go ahead and jump in. Why don't we jump in with Diablo Immortal, actually?
All right. That's actually a good place to jump in. We had talked briefly about what might be coming and what it might mean and so forth. One of the things that's great about this is that they're going to basically pick it up about 5 years after the end of Diablo 2. So the World Stone has been shattered, fragments of it are all over Sanctuary, and now its power is being, it's like beings from both hell and possibly even heaven are trying to find the pieces and use them to their own advantage. There's a figure called Scorn, Herald of Terror, who is like Diablo's henchman, for lack of a better word.
And one
he's out trying to find the various fragments to use them to bring Diablo back sooner.
He's an intern.
Yes.
That's infernal intern.
It's Diablo's Scorn, intern.
Intern of Terror. Can I get you some coffee, sir?
No, see, here's the thing that I really like about this, though, because a lot of people didn't realize that there is a 20-year gap between the end of Diablo 2 and the beginning of Diablo 3, and that 20-year gap has never really been addressed, not in detail. Like, there was a leap. There was just a big leap there.
Yeah, we just see a really old Deckard Cain at the beginning of Diablo 3. I mean, they've rebuilt Tristram over the past 20 years and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
we knew it had passed, but we don't know anything about it.
There wasn't anything out there history-wise for that time period. So that's where this fits in, and I really appreciate that, because it's like, yeah, I want to know how we got from the end of Diablo 2 to where we were at in Diablo 3, and I'm hoping that Immortal will tell us.
There's several things I want to have happen. One is to find out that the Diablo 2 barbarian is the barbarian we're seeing in Diablo Immortal, and he's the barbarian from Diablo 3's dad. Because I've wanted that to be the case forever.
Yeah.
Defeat Sonya from Diablo 3 to be the barbarian from Diablo 2's daughter. And I've wanted that from the beginning. I've always wanted that to be the case. I know that not all the characters get to be Lore, but that's one of the ones I want.
Is this because she's actually is your daughter and you'd just like them to reflect that?
Look, I cannot confirm nor deny at this time. No, it's just a Lore thing I've always wanted. I'm really looking forward to, they've talked about how they're going to show the foundation of the Demon Hunters, and how you're going to get to see the Demon Hunter Vala. You're going to get to see her like when she was just starting out. That's really cool. Since we know there's going to be Crusaders and Necromancers, I'm hoping that we get more Lore for what they were doing over that 20-year period. Because there's a pretty heavy implication that the person who teaches the Necromancer from Diablo 3 is the Necromancer from Diablo 2.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in seeing what happened to all those heroes who weren't Nephilim. Remember, because they were around before the Worldstone got destroyed. None of them were the Nephilim.
This was all back in Diablo 2.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm interested to see what happens with those guys. What are they up to? I mean, Vala obviously is a Nephilim. So the fact that we're going to get to see her beginnings means we're going to get to see at least one Nephilim before they know what they are. So there's a lot of stuff here I want to see. We're going to get to see like zones we haven't gotten to see in a while. One of them is like stuff from Diablo 2. The tower from Diablo 2 is going to be showing up.
Mm-hmm. I know.
So there's a lot of interesting stuff they can do with this. I mean, it is basically an MMO. Whatever we don't need to have the discussion on format and platform.
I was going to say, obviously there are people that are pressed about the platform, and that's fine. We're not here to talk about that at all.
No, we're here to talk about the story.
And the story is going to be...
One of the things that they kind of hammered home in the different panels was that this game absolutely does have a story behind it. Like, they are telling a story with this game. It is an RPG.
Did you guys see the part where they talked about how they're going to actually have multiple stories?
Yes.
Yes.
Like, this is going to be unfolding. They're going to have stories that progress. That, to me, is really... This game is an MMO, and that means we're going to get, unfolding Lore throughout its existence. As long as it's around, we're going to get to see more stuff, which I think is amazing.
They said they're starting it 5 years after the events in Diablo 2, right?
Yeah, it starts five years later, and then
so they've got 15 years of history to work with there, and there are a lot of stories that could be told in that time period, especially when you look at a game like WoW, and you think about the fact that World of Warcraft, one expansion is usually the course of a year, maybe two, in Azeroth's timeline.
Legion's a little bit of an exception, I think, but...
I don't know about Legion. I don't think that they've given a definitive, here's the beginning and end of Legion, and it's been a year or 2 years. I know that Mists of Pandaria spanned 2 years in the game's timeline, but it was an anomaly. It wasn't like the new normal. So, good question.
Now, what I'm going to be really interested in, too, is something that I've been asking about since Diablo 3 dropped. And in looking at the classes they're choosing to start with, and yes, they can expand it later through game mechanics or whatever, but I'm interested what the story is going to be behind the Amazons and the Assassins and the Druids and where they are, because we haven't heard anything about them at all in any of the mediums, like nothing in the books, nothing in the comics, nothing in the games since Diablo 2. So I'm really curious personally what's going on with those, because like we don't hear anything about them even in Diablo 3. Like there's no talk about them.
Yeah. Somebody did ask if there were, they said, why didn't you add the Druid? Why didn't you add the Druid? If this takes place between 2 and 3, why didn't you add the Druid class? And they replied to that and said that they were planning on adding additional classes as time went on. The Druid is not on the template for like the first ones that they want to add. They wanted to start out with Diablo 3 classes, of course, because people are used to playing those. But sure. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw druids come up at some point, though, because that was a ridiculously popular class in Diablo 2.
I need my werebear.
Yeah, well, people have been gunning to see him, so I'm like, okay, yeah, and you're absolutely right. I would love to hear more about that story. Like, where are they? They're gone in Diablo 3. Nobody, I mean, there's no reference to any of it, is there?
There's a mention of the island that the Amazons come from.
Yes.
But that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah, what's his name? Who I can't remember his name. Tyriel. Tyriel's like, what happened to the people we sent to the Skovos Isles? And Lorath Nol's like, yeah, we haven't heard back from them. Maybe, you know, we don't know what happened to them. So now, that's all we know about Skovos right now. We don't know anything about what happened to the Amazons in particular, if they're still out there or what.
Yeah, and the other reason that I really want to hear about the druids too is because the Worldstone and anything involving it seems like it would be very important to somebody who's like in tune with the land of Sanctuary. Like,
it would be relevant to their interests, yes.
The origin of the druids and the origin of the barbarians are closely tied.
Yes.
The barbarians were founded by Bolkathos, and the druids were founded by Vasily / Fiakagiar. And each of them were like, we got to protect this thing. And the Bolkathos was like, we got to protect it by getting as many big beefy dudes as we can. And big beefy ladies. We're not gender problem here. Everybody who's big and beefy can be involved. And just sit on top of this thing and kill anybody who comes near it. Fiakagiar was like, that's your solution to everything. And he's like, yes, because it works. Kill everything. Okay. While you're doing that, I'll take some of the less beefy ones. And I'll teach them about nature and the world.
Oh, and then they can transform into werebears and werewolves. Yeah. It's fine.
They'll be able to. Well, what will they be doing to defend the Worldstone? They'll turn into giant monsters. Okay, yeah, they'll kill things. Yeah, yes, brother, they will kill things. Okay, then I'm okay with this plan. So they broke off, and each of them had their own, you know, separate thing, which is great. But I do want to see what's happened to the children of Fiakagiar. What are they doing? They had more. It was more than just druids. They had a whole culture up there. And we have not heard or seen from it since the Worldstone got destroyed. Did something in this game, like did the shattered fragment of the Worldstone show up and corrupt them all? Are they now demons? Like, you know, what's going on? That would be something I'd like to see as well. There's a ton of stuff we could see. I mean, one of the things they mentioned was getting to see what made Malfiel give up.
Mm-hmm.
Because Malfiel, this is when Malfiel abandons the Anguirus Council and starts wandering the creation looking for some sort of meaning. This is when that happens. And we could get to see it. We could get to see Malfiel making his ultimate decision. So there's a ton of stuff that I would like to see, yeah.
I'm hoping, too, that like if this leads to more Diablo cinematics as well. Whether I don't care what the format is, I want more of those because we haven't had nearly enough of them over the years. And
but Joe, you know, then I have to get on the outfit, and it's just a lot of work.
Listen,
man.
Listen. This is what you get
mo-cap
paid barbarian dollars for.
Mocap is hard.
Yes. No, in all seriousness, yeah, I totally agree with you. I would love to see. First off, one of the reasons I wanted Diablo 2 remastered was because I'd love to see the remastered cinematics. Let's
Same.
Be real.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh.
So, but I would love to. The cinematic for Diablo Immortal is pretty cool. I would love to see them do more stuff like that. I want to see them take a page from WoW and have more cinematics in the game and have them used to like explain what's going on and show us stuff that we wouldn't get to see otherwise. So yeah, I'm totally down for that. That would be really great.
And really, regardless of what platform it's on, mobile devices are more than capable of playing video, like high quality video. So
unless it's my phone. I'm looking at the thing turns on.
I was going to say, modern mobile devices.
Yeah. Yeah, flip phones, not so much, Joe. Stop trying to install this on your Nokia.
Stop trying to make the sidekick happen. It's done.
Now, and that's the other thing, too, is I'm also hoping that, like Diablo 3, that Diablo Immortal is popular enough that it expands. Like, I would love to see something like this on the Switch as well, because that's something I do have that I would love, because it's a bigger screen, almost tablet like. I want these stories. I want to be able to play through these stories. There's so much potential here. And like you guys have said, we have that 20-year gap to fill in. There's so many cool things that they could do inside of that. I'm legitimately excited for this.
Yeah, like getting to see Westmarch, because they said Westmarch is going to be the the capital city for everybody.
Westmarch before it's all undeady?
Yeah, Westmarch before all hell breaks loose. But, you know, especially since it's Westmarch between games. It's Westmarch after Diablo 2 when, you know, the Dark Wanderer, you know, cut a swath through the whole world. So there's a ton of stuff. We should move on and talk about other stuff, but one of the things I want to see really badly is Blood Raven.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, for that matter, all three of them. We forget this, but there are three heroes in Diablo, the original Diablo. Those three heroes are canonically all appear in Diablo 2. All three of them do. And they're all three of them are messed up. We know what happens to, you know, I want to say Albrecht, but that's not his name.
I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But I know who you're talking
about. Aiden.
Yes.
Yeah. You know what happens to Aiden? He becomes the Dark Wanderer. Blood Raven, the rogue from Diablo 1, becomes a nightmare who kills all of her own friends and so forth, and we end up having to destroy her. And the wizard also shows up as a demonic monster. So all three of them got messed up. One of the things I'd love to see is more about where they come from, more about what happened to them. How did they end up getting messed up like that? Like, you know, the ones that weren't Aiden. There's a lot there I would love to see.
Okay, before we move on, and I didn't mention this right off the bat. I mean, I didn't think I needed to mention it right off the bat because we were starting off with Diablo, and we don't know much about the actual, like, storylines going on there, so there's not much there. We are going to talk, just so you guys are aware, you listeners are aware, we're going to talk about the stuff that was introduced in World of Warcraft. We're going to hit Overwatch first, but we will be jumping into the stuff with WoW. If you avoided BlizzCon specifically because you didn't want any spoilers about future stuff, you might want to listen to this episode later, because we're just going to talk about everything they talked about at BlizzCon. If it was mentioned at BlizzCon, we're going to mention it. So if you were avoiding any material just because you were kind of wary of spoilers, come back later. We'll still be here. We live on in the internet forever. All right. First, before we go into the WoW stuff, I want to talk about Overwatch because they did a number. Okay, so I was hoping for a McCree cinematic. I really was, because McCree's story is one of those stories that is really undefined. We had like some information about him. We knew he was part of the Deadlock gang when he was younger, and he was caught. They were busted by Overwatch during a sting operation, and McCree in particular, he was given a choice by Gabriel Reyes, and it was essentially, you can rot in jail forever, or you can join Blackwatch and work with me, and work under Overwatch, where nobody knows that we're there. And McCree chose the Blackwatch option, obviously. Why he picked it, I don't know, maybe he just didn't want to rot in jail, but over time he went from being kind of cynical about the whole thing to really embracing the idea of making up for his past sins and that kind of thing. That's about all we knew about McCree. We didn't know any of the history for the Deadlock gang, except that, you know, they were in Route 76. They were there, but who they were, how they got together, anything along those lines, didn't have any information on that. So I was hoping that we'd get that with the cinematic, and we did to a degree, but then we got some other stuff too. So let's talk about the cinematic, because the cinematic was really interesting. McCree shows up in Route 76. He's eating very casually at a diner, waiting for something to happen. That something is an explosion that causes a train to crash to the ground, which kind of creates how Route 76 looks as in the game today. And he did it on purpose because there was something on that payload that he wanted. And that thing on the payload that he wanted was an Omnic. But before he could get it, he ran into his old friend Ash, who is voiced by Jennifer Hale, and probably, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I was pretty gung-ho about that character the second she opened her mouth.
The minute I saw her, I was like, this is the new hero. Give me, let me play now. Come on.
Yeah. So Ash grew up being fed with a silver spoon in a life where it, you know, she was wealthy, her parents were wealthy, she had everything she wanted, but she didn't really. And she busted out of that with her trusty robot butler Bob and jumped into creating her own kind of family. And she was the leader of the Deadlock Gang, which was like, oh, okay, all right, that's how they came to be.
Well, not just the leader, she created it.
Yeah, she created it, and with like three other people. And McCree was one of those people that joined in. He wasn't a leader or anything. He was just working with them. But there's obviously some history, some implied history there between him and Ash.
Well, Michael Chu has said straight up that they didn't date at any point. They're not an ex-couple.
No, but she's got his picture on her bike. See, yeah, but so there's something going on there. Like, there's some. Well, it's either A, she liked him and never said anything, or B, she has his picture there so that when she ran into him again, she could punch him.
Well, I mean, look at the way he, if you look at the short, one of the things you notice is that he set the whole thing up to use them.
Oh,
to,
absolutely.
To bring the train down.
Absolutely.
So he said, you know, y'all never could resist a good tip. I mean, that's straight up. He's basically saying the only reason you're here is because I manipulated you to be here. And I think that was the wrong thing to say. Like, I thought it was a really interesting interaction between the two of them. Where the second she found out that's the thing he wanted, that he set it all up to get that thing, she was determined not to give it to him.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on between the two characters in that short.
There is.
That was fascinating.
Beyond that, though, once he takes everybody down, because of course he does, because he's McCree, he gets the payload, opens the payload. There is an Omnic in it. He has a little doohickey. Where he got it from, who knows, that he puts in that Omnic's forehead, and all of a sudden it wakes up. She wakes up. We've heard that her name is Echo. That's about all we know about her.
I totally thought it was Athena when we first saw it.
Well, the thing is it's not Athena, because we know. That Omnic has a Vishkar symbol on her forehead from the Vishkar, the same corporation that Symmetra was working for. So there's something going on here. The other interesting thing about this whole interaction between Echo and McCree is that McCree said they're calling the gang back together. They asked for me, but they need you, and basically told her where to go. So she was working with Overwatch at one point because she knew who he was talking about when he said the gang. But
he specifically says to go see the monkey.
Yeah, but here's the weird part, right? When they're talking, she looks down at his arm and says, "What happened?" I don't think that McCree's always been missing an arm, and I don't think that he was missing an arm when he was with the Deadlock Gang. It happened somewhere in between.
Even Ash says something about that too, because like earlier in the short, Ash points that out, like grabs, you know, his arm, says, "Oh, this is new."
Yeah,
you know, like doesn't say what happened, doesn't like just points out that like this wasn't there when she was around. Right?
There's no reference to what exactly happened there, and I know that. In the Overwatch Retribution, that cinematic, he had the mechanical arm in that, yeah?
Yeah.
He did.
Since we've had McCree, he's had the arm. In every media, every comic, every short, everything that he's ever been in, he's had the mechanical arm.
So somewhere between where he left Deadlock and joined Blackwatch and then left Blackwatch, he lost his arm. And he was with Overwatch for a while before he lost his arm, because Echo...
You're wrong, Joe.
Am I?
There's an Anna Overwatch picture with McCree in it. He's got his arm.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I'm looking at it right now.
Hey,
it's the picture with very, very young Farrah. Anna's an adult. She's standing between Reyes and Jack Morrison. You've got Reinhardt behind them. You've got Torbjorn in front, and I think Mercy behind him. And then you've got McCree behind Mercy. McCree has both arms.
Okay, you need to send me a link to that picture later, Rossi, because I'm going to be working. I'm trying to figure out the timeline here, because that's what I do.
Oh my God, you are absolutely right. You are absolutely right. It was Farrah as a young kid.
But yeah, that's pretty much that's what I do. Is figure out the timeline. So I'm like, okay, where did this timeline all sort out? And there is reference to Echo elsewhere in the original game art. When they had that first piece of concept art, there was an Omnic in the back that looked like her. So the thing is Echo is not the next hero. Echo is not a hero. Echo is just there. But this is the first time in a while that we've seen the recall thing addressed pretty directly since Reinhardt, really. Reinhardt's cinematic was him getting the notice about the recall and deciding whether or not to go back, and then he decided to go back. Brigida joined up with him afterwards. She chose to go with him and join Overwatch herself, or at least, you know, stay by Reinhardt's side as a direct result of that. But we hadn't seen McCree in particular. Like, this is a guy who used to work with Gabriel Reyes. It's also a guy who was really critical of what Gabriel Reyes was doing, particularly in later instances in as far as like Overwatch's history and downfall goes. So it was kind of cool seeing that story nudge forward a little bit. I'm just hoping, and I've got my fingers crossed, I am hoping that we see, you know, what's happening next. I just want them to start pushing this story forward. I'm not the only one, right?
No, you're definitely not. And one of the things that I took away from this, like just this entire short, this reveal, everything, is that it gives us very few answers, but then gives us more questions that sort of seem to propel us forward.
So many questions, because it's like, right. Why did McCree have that little doohickey? Why was Echo in that crate? Why was she on that train being moved? Where did she go? Did she miss the entire fall of Overwatch? She must have. Because she wasn't there when McCree lost his arm, which means she wasn't there when Blackwatch and everything else went haywire.
Well, one thing we know for sure, because I just went and checked, Jesse McCree has both arms when he's in Blackwatch.
Yep, during that event, Rossi pointed that out. I don't know how I missed that.
Oh, you know what? I wonder if he was there in the Swedish headquarters when everything went down between Reyes and...
I wonder.
Oh, we need that story. Michael so Chu, if you're listening, I don't think you are, but if you are, or if a friend of yours is, just point him at this, please. We need that story. We need that story about Overwatch. Just give us a novel. Like, you don't have to make a cinematic. You could give us a novel or a comic book or something, anything. Please. Just
so. Speaking of other interesting things, going back to Echo, apparently, and I just went back and after reading a little bit here, she was in the Overwatch Museum during the heist with Widowmaker and Reaper way back when. So, like, I'm wondering, like, there was a statue of her or something. I'm wondering if it was the actual her without her, like, AI unit or something, and that's what they were transported. Like,
maybe.
That would be interesting, because it would fit really well, because, like, the Overwatch Museum is an attempted heist by, you know, the Agents of Talon to get Doomfist Gauntlet back. What are they going to do with all the stuff that's there that's potentially dangerous? Move it. I could see that being something that they would do. I don't know. Like,
I gotta bring this up. They're talking about how Echo's original, the pitch meeting for Prometheus, the thing that became Overwatch, there was an Omnic named Iris.
Mm-hmm.
It was very similar to Echo. And they're talking about how maybe that's related to the Iris, the Omnic thing.
Yeah, the one that Zenyatta keeps talking about.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
Well, I mean,
I'm thinking about in terms of she might be linked to the whole Omnic Rebellion in the first place. The whole
I am seeing in additional material here that in early concept art for Iris, her design featured both the Athena and Vishkar Corporation logos at different points, but they were only added to fill in empty spaces on the design and did not accurately reflect her lore. I don't know if that's the case with Echo. Don't know. I need to do more research. I just need to do more research. But she's fascinating. Ash is fascinating. Do not get me wrong. I do love Ash, and I love everything going on with that story, and I love that we're getting more McCree, finally.
I just love that Bob has a handlebar mustache.
Bob is so good. Now, if they would go back to Hanzo's story, I would be really happy. Because when we last left Hanzo, Genji was like, hey, figure out your stuff. See ya, and then jumped off a building and we didn't see him again. And then we saw Hanzo later on in that comic, the end of the year comic, where he was just like buying a kid a cake or something. I don't know. Anyway, he was out in the middle of nowhere doing his own thing. We haven't seen anything about Hanzo since. Please give me more Hanzo. Thank you.
One of the things I'm seeing here, I looked in a couple of places, McCree is listed as a founder of the Deadlock Gang.
Yeah, he was one of the original four. Fish. Yeah, he
well,
was
and that's what
before.
Here's my thing. We now know where two of them are. Where are the other two? What happened to them?
That's an excellent question, and we don't have an answer for that.
Yep.
Things I want to see down the road, I'd like to see that.
I'm presuming either Overwatch took those legs out. Maybe one of them was with McCree when that sting operation went down. I don't know. Or they're still out there somewhere. I don't know. Overwatch seemed to be pretty focused on taking the Deadwatch gang out, though. Or taking the Deadlock gang. Excuse me. Deadwatch. Everything is Watch now. Yeah, there's more stuff here. There's more stuff here to go into. They introduced a lot of stuff.
Looking at the origin short with the image of the four founding members, it does look like it's a really, really, really young McCree.
Yeah.
In that original photo with his original arm, with his character hat, his little kerchief, and his cigar. I'm interested in the other two as well. Because, like, even if they were taken out, we know that Overwatch didn't exactly kill, like, them. And so, like, where are they? What are they doing
right now? In prison somewhere? How soon are they going to be broken out? I mean, it took a while.
If they haven't already been
pissed out of there, but are they working with Talon now? You know, I mean, there's all kinds of things. There's all kinds of questions going on there. And I don't know how any of this fits into the whole global conspiracy thing that Sombra has been eyeballing. And that's something they haven't revisited in a while either. There's so many different little disparate pieces here and there. And I just want them to pull together some kind of cohesive story and give it to us. I don't mind these little bits and pieces, but I would like something more substantial. You know what I mean?
I mean, if they're listening, I wouldn't say no to coming back to that whole graphic novel idea that you guys were throwing around at one point, because that would be really great. Just saying.
Okay. That's enough about Overwatch. Let's talk about World of Warcraft, because there was so much. There was so much that we got. One of the things that I want to talk about initially, because we didn't get a chance to address it on the podcast that we did, is I want to talk about the short that we got for 8.1, Lost Honor. It was a cinematic.
Oh, yes.
And we didn't get to talk about that much on the roundup yesterday, so I kind of want to address that straight up off the bat. Sourfang. We know that Sourfang has been taken into custody by the Alliance. If you're an Alliance player, you saw that happen during the Battle for Lordaeron. If you're a Horde player, you were aware of that happening, and that was reinforced when you broke into the stockades and you found Sourfang down there. And you have a little conversation with Sourfang, and he says, I don't want to go back. It's not my horde. I just want to stay here. And he stays put. He doesn't leave with you. He has every opportunity to leave with you, but he does not. In the Battle for Lordaeron, one of the last things that Anduin says to Sourfang is, we'll talk later. Lost Honor is them finally getting to talk. And that's a conversation. What'd you guys think of that one? Rossi, go ahead and talk. You haven't talked much.
Okay. I was glad that we finally got something that wasn't just Sarfang's Orcbane. Like, we actually got to see other people and, like, what the Alliance is thinking and doing. I loved the bit with Gen up front where he's like, you know, we're going to be conscripting the farmers next. And, you know, the Anduin's statement of, you know, this, I thought we were fighting to do something, but now it's like fighting to bring peace. Now it feels like we're just fighting. And I did like Sarfang when you finally get the, first off, Anduin, stop locking yourself in cages with giant orcs. But seriously, stop doing this. Why do you keep, your father would literally, if he wasn't already dead, he would be like beating his head against the wall if someone can, oh yeah, and he locked himself in with the Sarfang. Why? Why does he keep doing this? But I did like the moment between the two of them. I liked Sarfang finally just admitting that she's gonna ruin everything. She's gonna destroy the Horde. I want the Horde back. For all that, you know, he is a creature of the place he came from. He is very much the best and the worst of what orcs can be. He's done the worst things possible. He's done the best things possible. He's interesting for that. And I did like the exchange between the two of them. I'll admit, I didn't see Anduin sort of whoopsie daisy, oops, I seem to have forgotten to close this door, oh my, moment. That was new to me. You know,
that fits with Anduin's character, though, in my opinion.
Yeah, it does. I just didn't expect it. I didn't think that was going to be... I thought they were going to basically have Sarfang break out. I didn't think it was going to be, break out in quotes. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, as good as surfing is though, like this to me makes a little more sense than, you know, and don't get me wrong, I love Sarfang. He is one of my absolute favorite characters, Horde side. Always has been, because he's complicated and his hands are dirty and he has real, for lack of a better term, real emotion compared to some of the other characters that we've interacted with over the years. But even I don't think he's capable of escaping Stormwind by himself. Like, that's a tall order.
Look,
even for
him. Did you ever try to raid Orgrimmar back in Classic? Because he packed a punch at the front gates.
My thing isn't that he's powerful enough to break out. My thing is I've been in the stockades of like Swiss cheese. Like, sure. I mean, a null stage to break out, for God's sake. If Hogger can seriously threaten to escape, then I think Sorfang can pull it off. But I liked that. In a way, I felt like this was more fitting because Sorfang didn't have the motivation to leave before now.
He didn't see a way perfectly, out. He had a way out. He didn't take it. He was perfectly content to sit there and eventually die. Well, I wouldn't say content, because he was really angry about the fact that he never got his honorable death or anything like that. And maybe that's why he kind of tried to threaten Anduin a little bit, but it wasn't working with Anduin. Because that's not who Anduin is. Anduin isn't going to approach it from a oh, you tried, you know, you're trying to intimidate me, I'm going to stab you, or what. That's not Anduin. Anduin, what I really liked about this cinematic is that Anduin finally came face to face with something that maybe he didn't really want to be thinking about too much, and it was the fact that they can't beat Sylvanas Windrunner. They cannot take her down by themselves.
Well, no,
they can't. Grinding soldiers through the whole war thing. And yes, Sylvanas has been doing the same dang thing on her side, but Sylvanas can raise those soldiers from the dead and her army is still strong. So how are you supposed to combat that? Really, how are you supposed to combat that? And that's what Anduin's had to struggle with here, is it's like, how do I beat her? I don't think we can beat her, but I know somebody who I think does know how,
well,
or has some ideas.
But the thing is, it's a very Anduin moment too, because it's not necessarily a moment of, I think this is a powerful warrior that can wage war with me or through the shadows or anything like that. It's, this is a very strong figure in the Horde who doesn't like what's going on and can be divisive, who can get people to his side and erode her power base. Because right now, who really, besides Bane, who is incredibly soft-spoken and hasn't really done anything this expansion yet, is there to stand up and say, yo, listen, Dark Lady, I know you got plans, but this ain't the way we want to do it, and this is wrong, and, you know, nobody's doing that. Nobody, so everybody's just kind of like going along with it.
Here's what Anduin knows about the Horde. The Horde is based on a system of honor.
Yep.
That's what he was taught. That's what, you know, probably he learned from Jaina from some aspects, because Jaina was really close with Thrall and understood
even his
all
father.
That. And he, but I mean, even meeting with Bane, meeting with Bane when everything went down with Karen, that was one of those things that Anduin took away with him. The stuff that the Horde is doing right now is not honorable. And Anduin knows, and there's that connection in his head that, if the Horde was running like this, and they're being run like this now, I saw this once before. I saw it with Garrosh Hellscream. What happened with Garrosh? They turned against him. And maybe there's the potential for that here, because really what Sylvanas is doing, not everybody's going to agree with it. Sourfang represents, he's like a mentor figure for Anduin from the other side. And he's someone that could potentially teach Anduin, look, this is how the Horde thinks. This is how the Horde is supposed to think. And this is what Sylvanas is doing right now.
Well, and to sort of like just finish my earlier thought real quick, it's just, I think that even beyond that, which is absolutely true, that's something he could be for Anduin. Even if he doesn't do that with Anduin, he's still a figure that's going to start pulling people away from what's going on with the Horde. Because if Sarfang feels like this, other people are going to feel like this. And it is slightly different than what happened with Garrosh, because Garrosh was, you know, whipping everybody up into this fervor and frenzy of, this is honor, this is strength, this is how we get back what was taken from us.
Yeah, and Anduin didn't know that, though. Anduin just knew that when things went down, the Horde turned against their own war chief.
Very, very true. But at this point, it's now, like I said, it's this erosion of her power base. Because at the end of the day, if all she has left is the Forsaken, like, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of Forsaken, but the Forsaken versus literally everybody else, my money's on everybody else. And Sarfang is that person that could start drawing those orcs that are, like, not happy about it away. The Torn would definitely flock to something like that. You know, you could see the Pandaren.
Bane's looking for an excuse to book it.
The Pandaren would move away from this as well. Like, it's now you have a figure that can do that, where right now there isn't anybody stepping up to do that. There's nobody fighting against Sylvanas's wishes.
And I think the other important key takeaway from this is that Anduin did leave that door open. He left that door open, and he did it deliberately. And it wasn't an, oopsie, I'm going to let the Horde prisoner go. It was a message to Sourfang. And the message was, I trust you. That's all it was.
Go handle your business.
I trust you.
That's what I was trying to get about in terms of why Sourfang left now.
Yeah.
He didn't leave before because he didn't see a way out. He saw a way out physically. Sure, he could have gotten out of the cell. That's not my point. And he saw a way out in terms of death, but and he could have had a death anytime he wanted, but it would have been at the hands of a few Stormwind guards. And that's, you know, okay, but that's not really what he was going for with his honorable death.
It's hardly honorable.
But when Anduin leaves the cell door open, Sourfang now sees a way out of this situation. And the situation isn't I'm locked in a cell somewhere. The situation is the Horde is being led by a madwoman from his perspective. I'm not saying she's actually crazy. I'm saying from his perspective, she's dishonorable to the point of madness. Like, everything she does is unpredictable to him because it will not be honorable.
Yep. And not only that,
it's
but
just,
I mean,
beep,
like,
boop,
she's
beep, boop, does not compute in orcish brain, you know.
Well, and it's like even with how she, like, presents her tactics, it's still like it doesn't make sense to Sarfang in the way that he would wage war, even if there was a need to wage war, right? Like,
yeah, this is a guy who has firsthand experience of what Gul'dan was like.
Mm-hmm.
Our Gul'dan. He has firsthand experience of how the old Horde was led because he was the second in command for a while there.
He has firsthand experience of going through the dark portal for the first time and setting foot on a strange new world. That was
him. My point is that he understands stuff like raising the dead to use them in your army. He's seen that before. It's not alien or new to him, but he knows where it ends. It's not when Sylvanas is doing that kind of thing. The whole reason it's so shocking and abominable is because he knows where that ends. It doesn't end with victory for your side. It ends with you destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
For all that Sylvanas, like right now, here's the thing. We've been talking about it like, you know, Anduin can't beat Sylvanas. I don't think it's that he doesn't think the Alliance can beat her. I think he doesn't want to pay the price.
Yeah.
That it would take.
Because they've already paid so much in Legion.
Plus, right now, the Alliance is winning.
Yep.
Right now, as of 8.1... when 8.1 comes out, the story is that
the upper hand, yeah.
The Alliance is winning this fight, but it's costing them. It's a cost he doesn't want to pay. We know this is happening, but it wasn't specifically mentioned at BlizzCon, so I don't know if I want to drag it too much in. But we know what happens with the Zar'alor. We know that battle happens. That's something that's in the lore. Anduin is looking at this. He's looking at what happens with the Night Elves. The Night Elves don't ask him for permission to go back over. Tyrande does not say, hey, do you mind if we... She just goes.
Yeah.
And I think that we should probably... this is a good place to dovetail. So go ahead and finish what you were saying, but...
But my point is that Anduin is looking at the Alliance and saying, we're losing it. We are not... What are we going to be like when this is over? If we don't... If we just try and grind them down... If we just try and beat them with pure military force, maybe we can do it. But what are we going to be? What are we going to be when it's done? That's why he wants to reach out to the other side. Because if the other side helps, if you get the Horde to turn on their war chief, if you get people that you can work with on the other side, maybe you can't ever be friends.
But you can have peace.
Yeah, you can at least stop fighting. And that's the thing. The fighting is its own problem.
It's building that it's building that common bond that he was trying to do in Before the Storm.
This is something I appreciate on a couple different levels, and I was literally just talking about this on Twitter before we started recording. One of my biggest gripes has always been how short-sighted every decision we make is. Whether it's an NPC, an important NPC, or the player characters, we are always in the heat of the moment. We are always thinking about the immediate fight and not what the aftermath is going to be. Like, even when we went to Antorus, like, we went because we had to. We knew we had to. But look at everything that happened afterwards, right? Like, we're still dealing with that fallout as well. We're still dealing with fallout from many expansions ago because we didn't think, we just acted. Anduin is one of those NPCs, one of those characters, one of those lore figures that thinks ahead. He thinks long term.
I think he learned part of that from Velen.
I think honestly. So too. Well, Velen, his dad at the end as well, because Varian was starting to get to that point as well and starting to look things more analytically long term. Like, even Gen has calmed down to a point where he's slightly less like a rabid dog without a leash. Like, we're getting to this point where these figures are starting to act like leaders, and that's important to me. And Anduin is chief among them. He's thinking long term. He's thinking, what is the effect? And what we're seeing from him here is literally that. It's a show don't tell moment, and I appreciate that. It's one of the times that I appreciate Anduin so much for that, because of that.
Okay, let's go ahead and switch gears here, and actually I'm going to kind of segue into the other cinematic that we saw at BlizzCon, because it involves the Night Elves, which we were just talking about, and that would be the Terror of Darkshore cinematic, or as I like to call it, this is why you don't piss off the Calderay, because dang,
I have,
I have been waiting for Malfurion to show his teeth, man. I have been waiting for that dude. He must have the patience of I don't know what, but we finally see him go off in that cinematic, and it is terrifying.
I've always thought this about Malfurion. One of the things I've thought about him for a long time is that, keep in mind, he slept for a lot of it, so he wasn't conscious. He was in the dream for a lot of it, but 10,000 years ago, Malfurion lost his temper.
Mm-hmm.
He got mad and decided, I'm going to use my rage to solve this problem. I'm going to solve it this way. And he blew up Kalimdor. He imploded the continent. He did that. That was him. Now, we can make the point that it was necessary. I'm not disputing that it was necessary. But what does it do to you when you end your world? You end everything you grew up with. He changed
the face of the planet. That was him. Yeah.
And we talk about Suramar, and we talk about how Suramar was Tyrande's home city, and about how, you know, Malfurion was from Suramar too. And it's gone. It was gone until until Legion. He ruined it. He ended it as far as he knew. Everything he grew up with, he destroyed. And yes, he soldiered on. And yes, they tried to make a new world. And yes, he was the leader for a lot of it. But imagine, Malfurion was never the confident, take charge one of the two brothers. That was his brother. That wasn't him. He didn't want, if Illidan could have believed him, he could have realized his brother never wanted to usurp him or eclipse him or even be separated from him. But Illidan couldn't believe it. When Tyrande chose Malfurion, it poisoned Illidan inside, but it was also a complete shock to Malfurion. He's always been that guy who would have been happier just studying nature in the background, not having to step up, not having to be in charge, and he got put in charge. And from experience, that makes a rage that festers. And the fact that he's kept it as calm as he has for as long as he has, and really tried hard with the neutrality thing, and we've all complained about the neutrality thing. I've complained about it, that he was too passive. He wasn't doing things. I think in Cataclysm, I complained about it a lot.
I'm right there with you. There with you.
The whole Firelands thing was just like, Malfurion, what are you doing? You just came from Darkshore. What's going on down there? Like, yeah. I think what people tend to forget about Malfurion is that he did have that presence in Legion, and he was there. He was there in Val'Shirah. We didn't see him a whole heck of a lot after Val'Shirah, but you also have to consider what he lost at the end of Val'Shirah.
Yeah.
Ysera's gone.
And Cenarius is back in the dream.
Yeah.
Well, Ysera is not gone. She's in the dream now, too, right?
Yeah, like, but both, they're there if you go into the dream, but they're not out in the world.
Sure.
They're effectively dead. And
they're gone.
And Ursaq. Yeah. Don't forget that as well.
Yeah, it's a huge trauma, and it happens on his watch, and then his people get destroyed. He never wanted that tree in the first place. Teldrassil is not something that he flat out rejected it. He told Fandral, no, we shouldn't make it. It's presumptuous.
Yeah. Yeah.
If the Aspects wanted us to have our immortality back, they would have said so. They have not. You can't just decide you're going to force it. You can't. This is arrogance itself. And the only reason that it happened was because Fandral knocked him unconscious, you know, with what was the name of that stupid marrow grain? Yeah, with marrow grain.
Yep, which we held with.
Yeah. In my defense, I didn't do those quests happily. I did do them though. So, but yeah, there's a lot. The past decade or so, however long it's been in game since original, you know, classic WoW came out, and we Malfurion was taking his nappy nap because he'd been poisoned, and you know he wasn't around, to now, has been for them astonishingly active. These are people who live thousands of years. Even if they're not immortal, they live thousands of years.
You have to look at, they're 10,000 years old. The last couple of years have been kind of like the blink of an eye, but what a blink.
Yeah, it's, I think a lot of people in the real world can understand that feeling of, oh God, what's going on? The Night Elves would have that in spades. Everything changed twice. Like, building that giant world tree and actually building a city in it, that's like, what? Like, why did we need a city again? Oh, because the other people need us to have a city so that they can visit it.
I mean, Hyjal was gone. Was gone at the end of the Third War, and they needed a new place to stay. So they built, Fandral built Teldrassil to give them a place to stay, and also to try and get the immortality thing back, which didn't work, obviously. But he was also doing a bunch of shady stuff on the side because old gods. And Xavius and everything else that happened in Stormrage. Stormrage is one of those underrated novels. There are elements in there that I didn't really care for, but there are also elements in there that are good as far as, telling the story of what happened with Teldrassil, and also what happened with Fandral. Everything that leads up to where we see Fandral in Cataclysm happens in Stormrage, so I would recommend going and checking it out if you haven't. There, like I said, some parts work better than others. There are some shaky pieces in there, but it's good lore. I mean, it's all good lore. What I appreciated here, though, was Tyrande. We have Tyrande with the dark eyes. She's taken on the Night Warrior, which is like another aspect of Ilun. And what I really liked in this cinematic was you saw the imagery. Tyrande is seeing through the eyes of that owl, and that owl is shining like the moon, just a beacon. And everything that she sees is relayed to Malfurion. And where that owl appears, Malfurion is not far behind, which is kind of cool. I don't know if you guys noticed it, but at the very end of the cinematic, when it was panning back in the sky, you saw the moon, but it was eclipsed. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's like a black moon.
Yeah.
And also, Teldrassil is now wrapped in some kind of ghostly mist.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, it's talk about how Tyrande looks, like, super serious. Like, when they cut to her and Malfurion at that last scene, she's got the horror movie eyes going on. Like,
the whole thing, the cinematic played like a horror movie.
It did. It really did.
I actually liked that they, for once, the Horde, who are often depicted as the monsters, orcs and trolls.
Oh, they were terrified.
They were getting murdered. Like, he was butchering them. Like, he comes out of the darkness, and then you don't see that Blood Elf Paladin anymore. You never see that Blood Elf Paladin again. Just one second, she's like, what's going on? Next second, gone, and you never see her again.
And then the thing with the orc laying on the ground, and Malfurion just does this gesture, and the ground starts eating that orc alive. I'm like, this is why you don't tick off an archdruid. This is why, we haven't seen Malfurion snap ever. He's been this calm presence for so long, And he's kind of exuded that calm presence for so long, thousands of years.
I hope that the Horde isn't dumb enough to send Hamul up.
To what?
I hope they're not dumb enough to send Hamul Rune Totem up there.
Oh yeah. No.
That would not be good. No. Do not do that. If Hamul feels his loyalty to the Horde outweighs, then Hamul is going to die.
I don't see that for that character. I don't think Hamul goes up there
and he's like, look, Malfurion, we have to calm this down. Malfurion would be like, you want to calm it down? Help me.
Now, I could totally see Hamul being one of the first ones to go to Sarfang's side and be like,
I find it interesting, and I'm kind of wondering where Hamul is sitting in all of this, because Hamul was the one that originally came to Cairn when the Forsaken wanted to join the Horde and said, you know, maybe we should, because we can help them.
Yeah, like, and that on the
was,
other
that,
hand...
Hamul was the one who argued for their inclusion and was kind of one of the pivotal factors for why Thrall said, okay, we'll let you guys in the Horde.
Yeah, but keep in mind it was M'Gatha Grim Totem who
first...
Yeah, so there's that. Plus, Hamul has the problem of basically being... Right now he's down there in Silithus trying to deal with that.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. I feel like at least to some degree Hamul would be like, look, while we're doing all this stupid things we're doing, the planet is dying. Have you not heard the Diamond Dwarf screaming about it? Because that's happening. The planet, the thing we're standing on, the whole world that we all live on, is dying right now. Like, as I'm talking to you. So there's a lot could happen with Hamul. I just don't want to see the Hamul fighting Malfurion. I don't want to see that. I don't think it's a good idea.
If they do that, I will be very angry. They better not.
Okay, we're going to move on just a little bit and scooch a little bit forward. And this is where we're really diving into spoiler material, folks, because we're going to talk about the 8.2 reveals that we were given. Hello, not one, but two new zones. One of them kind of expected. I mean, it was sort of a given that we would be facing off against Ashara eventually. So Nazjatar, not, I mean, a surprise because I wasn't expecting it quite so soon. But okay, I knew that one was coming. The other one, let's talk about the other one for a second. We're going to Mechagon. And
yeah.
What?
So that was a complete surprise.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's realized. I don't remember anyone. I know people talking about the possibility of them as an allied race, but nobody was like, and yeah, we're going to go to a lost continent of mechanical gnomes. You didn't know that? Yeah, that's totally happening.
Well, it's not even a lost continent. It's an underground. It's like an entire undermire of mechanical gnomes.
Yeah, I mean, I've wanted them to do stuff with gnomes and mecha gnomes for a long time. I mean, I even wrote something for the old site called Cult of the Mechanical, where it was about how the like mechanical gnomes could like be a threat.
Yes.
But this is like, no, I did not see this coming. Like, what? What happened? Oh. Mecha who? What?
And not only that, but like it's delightfully dark and creepy as well. Like, which is something like we joke about with gnomes a lot, but or at least I do. But we haven't really had a showcase of like the dark side of gnomes and how that genius is just really kind of close to evil and weird.
One of the best gnome role players I ever met. Her character was just shy of completely insane. But she was a brilliant scientist, and a lot of the stuff that she did was really questionable because she worked with that whole body parts replacing body parts, that kind of like there was that madness going on with. She was so good, and I can't remember her name now, but a lot of the stuff that I'm seeing with the Mechagon area is kind of reflective of that, and I can't wait to see it. The way that it's working in Mechagon, there's this guy who's King Mechagon, and the gnomes that are with him, there's a society. There's like a secret society of gnomes where the more of your body that you've replaced with mechanical parts, robot parts, maybe leaning back towards that whole mechagnome ancestry that they have, the more highly respected you are. And there's a group of outcasts that aren't necessarily cool with this idea called the Junker Gnomes. But if you look at the concept art for these mecha gnomes. It's robot bodies with gnome faces, and their eyes have been replaced in some cases by mechanical pieces. I mean, it's just creepy. It's like steampunk society on this horrifying level. When people were kicking around the idea of mecha gnomes as being an allied race, I was like, well, that just doesn't seem very relevant. Why would that?
And then the tweets came.
Yeah. This immediately makes it relevant because it's coming from a different direction. Because when I hear mecha gnomes, I think of the dudes up in Northrend that we left behind a long, long time ago. I don't think of, oh, there's a brand new city, a continent that we've never seen, full of creepy gnomes.
And one of the things I like about it too is it sort of mirrors the why can't I think of the name of them in Aldir? The ones that wanted to return to stone. The cat centaurs.
Tolvir.
Tolvir.
Yeah.
It sort of mirrors that, right? Because one of the things we've seen by some of these races that have been isolated is when they succumb to the curse of flesh, they don't like that. They don't want to be flesh anymore. They want to go back. And it makes perfect sense that like gnomes of all creatures would be like, we were once purely mechanical. We remember that. I miss that. Let's be mechanical again. I don't need this arm. Rip.
What's interesting is they didn't remember it.
Because you go back to
Mechazod, when Mechazod of all people.
Well, the ones we've interacted with don't remember it.
Yeah, but it's still interesting because when Mechazod shows up, he wants to de-curse the flesh everybody. And he seems to think he can do it to everybody.
And he's so like, horrifyingly friendly about it.
I honestly, Mechagon, to me, I bet you 10 to 1 he's going to be like Mechazod. He's going to be a similar, you know, kind of figure. He's probably going to be a primordial mecha gnome, one of the original ones.
Or another Watcher, because that's the other thing, too. Don't forget, like, we had a Titan Watcher in Northrend that was a mecha gnome, you know?
But he wasn't originally. That's what's really interesting about Mimiron. Mimiron wasn't originally a mecha gnome. He didn't look like that. That's what they rebuilt him as when he died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because Loken basically got him killed, and he didn't expect the mechanomes to come together and be like, we got to save him. So they rebuilt a place for his essence to go, and then he went kind of nuts because he wasn't originally a mechanome. So if there's another mechanome watcher, that would imply some things. It would be interesting.
I can't wait to see what's in this zone. It is going to be there's a mega dungeon involved. The mega dungeon is kind of on the lines of Return to Karazhan, where it's been only for a while.
Oh, wait a minute.
What?
I just remembered something. Ooh. So, wait. Okay. So, remember when the Watchers like battled with the Elemental Lords?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, wasn't Mimiron like the one that fought alongside Loken against Neptalon the Tidehunter?
Mm-hmm.
It is perfect that they are bringing this back up now. Absolutely perfect.
Oh.
Because we're talking about going to Nashatar. Well, that doesn't mean there's not other things that were trapped under the water when they were fighting Neptalon. And we know that they clashed armies, not just individuals, armies. There's going to be something tying these events together. I can feel it.
That would make sense because, then the Mechagnomes were the servants of Mimiron. They would have probably been his army.
Yeah. Let's talk about the other zone that we're getting, because there's a lot of history here. We are going to Nazjatar. It's the ancient land of the Naga and the home of Queen Ashara. The way it was described is that we are going to be under attack by the Naga, and we're going to follow a trail out into the ocean, and we're going to find this crack in the ocean, and in there is Nazjatar. It's rising out of the sea, which is only kind of appropriate because I believe that this patch is called Rise of Ashara. So it's almost appropriate on a literal level because it's not just Ashara rising as this horrifying new enemy or anything. Nazjatar is rising out of the sea, which is weird.
But it makes a lot of sense, though. Like, in the grand scheme of things, like if she's using this as her opportunity to sort of take over, which you kind of get a little bit about that in the Shrine of Storms. Like, you get a little bit of story about that and what's at play here. And I was always starting to think, I don't think she was really corrupting the humans at behest of necessarily her old god patron. I think she was sort of doing it herself to see if she could. Because, like, oh, I created Naga, or, you know, I can still create Naga. What happens if I do that with humans? Do I get more servants? This is great. But now all this chaos is going on. All this war is going on. And she still has this wonderful, wonderful army of fish elves to sort of stage war on and capitalize on that sort of weakness that's going on right now. Take advantage of that war that we're waging on these lovely islands that just happen to be right next to where she is.
Well, and the thing is, I mean, we see it reflected in the Lost Honor short. Anduin's mm-hmm. looking at what remains of the Alliance forces. They are depleted. And it's the same thing with the Horde forces. They are being depleted as well. Both sides are waging war, but they are losing soldiers left and right. They are losing people who are capable of fighting these kind of battles. And those heroes, those paragons that we had wielding artifact weapons back in Legion, those artifact weapons are gone. Sure, those heroes might still be there, but they aren't working with superpowers anymore. So things are getting limited and things are getting scarce. And I feel like Ashara is like, yeah, now I can take advantage of that. Because guess what? My forces outnumber the both of you. And my powers eclipse anything that you could throw at me.
And it makes me wonder, too, like how she can expand that and how that's going to play into it as well. Because like Sylvanas raising the dead, like we don't know how far Ajara's influence or power, or if you want to call it corruption has spread and how much are fully under her sway. We know she can talk to Tide Sages because they hear her. Some of them go crazy. And I don't know what else that's going to like bring out from it, but I think it's going to be an interesting dynamic there.
I think it's kind of interesting to me because, during the Warcraft Q&A panel, I don't know if you guys heard that one or not, someone asked something about, is Sylvanas going to go the way of Garrosh? And Alex Afrasiabi, he said something interesting. He said, what do you think Sylvanas says when or sees when she looks, or what do you think she thinks when she thinks about Garrosh Hellscream? She thinks, that's an amateur. There's an amateur. He's an amateur. I can do so much better. And
well,
I think that if you look at that, and you think about Ashara. Ashara is looking at the rest of the known world as it exists right now and says, you are all children compared to what I'm capable of. Because she was capable of a lot when she was leading the Night Elves so many thousands of years ago. And that was before the old gods empowered her. So
now
I don't know what we're going to get when we get there, but it's going to be crazy.
There's another interesting part of that, too. And this was part of that when we started talking about the new stories, old heroes, new stories. And they put up that image of, what was it? It was Anduin. It was Jaina. It was, I can't remember who from the Horde side, besides
Rokan.
Sylvanas.
Rokan, I think.
But then Sylvanas. And Sylvanas was the interesting one. And I tweeted this out after seeing it.
Oh, my
because
God.
This ties in with it. She's got Xalatath.
She's just
that
hanging
out. That is absolutely Xalatath.
It looks just like Xalatath to me. She and made a new friend.
She made a new friend. And it would fit in perfectly with what we were talking about like months ago at this point. Where, yeah, you know, Sylvanas looks at Garrosh and says, that was an amateur. Yeah, that was an amateur trying to take a heart of an incomplete old god. Well, here's Xalatath. It's a piece of an old god. Let's her talk to an old god. Maybe she's making a deal. Like, does that mean she winds up aligning somewhat with Ashara? Like, how does it all going
to
work out? Like, this is really interesting.
I guess the question to me is she making a deal with this chatty talking blade, or has she got it under her control? Because I don't know what kind of bargain Sylvanas would... I mean, she made that bargain with Helya, and that
I was
going to
say,
anywhere.
We see that she's capable, or she's willing to make bargains, especially if it suits her needs.
Yeah, but
or
that, one
her what
with,
she wants.
That one with Helya didn't go anywhere, so maybe she's tired of making bargains, and maybe she's trying to take things by force, and maybe Xalatath is just the thing that will help her do that.
We have to wait to see what happens in the 8.1 mini raid, the one underneath the Shrine of the Storm there.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Because that's where the Xalatath stuff is going to be dealt with. That's where the return of Xalatath happens. We know that to a certain degree. We don't know much about it. So a lot of that is like we can assume we know what's going on, but we don't actually know what's going on.
And this could go in one of two ways, too. I mean, Sylvanas could be working with Xalatath and working with the old gods, which would be kind of contrived. I mean, we've seen it before. Or she could be using Xalatath to manipulate the old gods because the Void was scared of her. I'd like to think that the Void was scared of her for a reason. Maybe it's because she's capable of doing things with the Void that other creatures are not for some reason that we don't comprehend yet. I don't know.
Well, because she's not bound to the cycle of life and death like everything else. She's not bound to light and dark like everything else. So it would make perfect sense. Like, there's so many things they could do with this.
They do not live. They do not die.
Mm-hmm.
They are beyond the cycle.
Now,
Apply something with the Void Lords. The Void Lords themselves might effectively have died.
I don't know.
Like, they might be dead things, manner of speaking. Which doesn't mean that they're from, you know, the Death Pole and all that. Shadowlands are a different place, but that's something to think about.
No, the one thing that I hope for this, and this is something that I've said before, is I think echoed by a lot of people, is we definitely don't want a Garrosh 2.0 story, and it sounds like we're not going to get a Garrosh 2.0 story, which makes me happy.
No.
And that is good because we've said this before. I know Rossi has said this. Whether you love or hate Sylvanas, she is a great literary character because of how complicated she is. I like that.
Yeah, you don't have to like her as a character to accept that she's an interesting character. She's a multi-layered character. I mean, I like her for what she does for the story. I don't like her. Like, I'm not a fan of her. I think she's monstrous and evil. But well, you need monstrous evil people
in
the story.
Yeah, it was the same thing with Garrosh. I loved Garrosh Hellscream as a character. I thought he was phenomenal, and I'm still kind of upset that he ended the way that he did, but it was almost appropriate because he kind of came back to that full circle point, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't agree with anything that he did. I thought that everything that he did was horrible. All the stuff he was doing to the Horde was horrible. What he did to Theramore was horrible, but he was a great character. Like, he was just a great... Sometimes you need those characters to do those things that you don't like. You got to have those characters. If everybody in a game just did things that you liked, you would have Animal Crossing, and that's not World of Warcraft.
Heck, quite frankly, there's people in Animal Crossing I don't like, and they do horrible things. Sylvanas, the Tom Nook of Warcraft.
Okay. I think we will go ahead and end it there unless there's any other little lore tidbits you guys want to talk about.
Not small enough that we could get to it in the amount of time we have left.
Okay. Joe, you got anything you want to touch on real quick?
Nah, real quick would be a real, real stretch there.
Okay. All right, then we'll go ahead and wrap it up here. But you guys, if you have any questions about any of the lore that was introduced at BlizzCon, we didn't even touch on Heroes of the Storm. Maybe we should have, but that's okay. We'll just go ahead and let that rest. If you guys have any questions, though, for Lore Watch about any of the lore information that was introduced at BlizzCon or anything that's coming up in World of Warcraft for that matter, because, you know, we've been talking about that too, you can go ahead and email that to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Just be sure that you put Lore Watch in the subject line so that we know that it's intended for the show. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch, and your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Final thoughts, you guys. What was the one thing that stuck with you the most lore-wise from BlizzCon 2018? Joe?
Oh, God, you're going to make me pick one thing? That's
one thing. The thing that stuck out the most.
I would have to say that we probably the Najatar stuff. Because, again, we knew we were going there, but the scope of it, like, it's growing. It's bigger than we anticipated as far as its importance in what's going to happen in this expansion. And that makes me very, very happy. Close second, the fact that Sylvanas is Xalatath.
Okay. Rossi, what about you? just the one lore thing that's been sticking out to you from BlizzCon 2018?
That we're going to get to find out what happened between Diablo 2 and 3. Like, that 20-year period of time is going to get covered. There's going to be a story for it. They're going to see what happened, what's been going on, and, you know, that to me is fascinating. Like, that's something I've wanted for a long time. So I'm really excited about that. That's my thing for this BlizzCon. That was my number one. I have plenty of number two and threes and so forth. There was a laundry list of things, but that's my number one.
Okay, I'm going to go the other direction from you guys. And I will say, you know, all of this World of Warcraft stuff, utterly fascinated, completely. I can't wait to dive into it all. But I need to know more about Echo. And I need to know more about the fall of Overwatch. And I need an Overwatch novel. Please, guys, just hand one over. It's okay. I'll write it for you. Call me. Come on. There was just way too much Overwatch. There was just enough of a taste there to immediately leave me wanting so much more. So maybe we'll get that at some point. I don't know. Anyway, that wraps us up for Lore Watch. Thanks, you guys, so much for listening. And we will see you again in 2 weeks.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.